That night the city burnt, and the mother church of the city burnt with her. And yet the tower and the spire still stand, soaring to the sky, and I feel that's an emblem of the eternal majesty and love of God.
Greetings. You are tuned into the Miserable Offenders podcast. Pull up a chair and join the conversation as we seek answers to life's big questions, drawing wisdom from the well of traditional Anglican theology. This is a production of the North American Anglican.
Well, welcome back to the Miserable Offenders podcast. I'm so happy to have you here. I'm your host, Jesse Nigro. I am the editor-in-chief of the North American Anglican Journal, which is northamanglican.com. And today I'm joined by both Isaac Rayberg and Andrew Brazier. I tried to make them into one person. That would be a mistake. Gentlemen, Andrew, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, Andrew Brazier, rector for Church of the Good Shepherd over in Pelham, Alabama. Yeah, if you mix the two of us up, you'd really get the worst aspects of me diluting both. Isaac needs to be the venerable, so I'll kick it over to Isaac to introduce himself.
Well, I would say that we've never been seen in the same place at the same time, but that's actually not true. So, yes, I'm Isaac Rayberg, the rector at All Saints Anglican Church and the Archdeacon for Liturgy in the Anglican Diocese of All Nations. Glad to be here as always.
Thank you, my two co-hosts. So today at Miserable Offenders, we are prepared to discuss an article that made a bit of a splash about a week ago in the Anglo world by Gillis Harp at the Gospel Coalition, titled "Anglicans, Let's Stay True to Our Confessional Heritage." Eh? You almost want to throw an "eh" at the end of that. I'm not sure if you gentlemen saw the same thing that I did, but I saw a pretty divided response between "yes, amen," heart emoji, or also "this is the wrong-headed." I sort of saw a bit of both. And I have to say that I have mixed feelings about the article. I think it says some good things, but there are some things missing, or even perhaps that I think the Reverend gets wrong here. I won't say Father Harp. I don't think he'd appreciate that. But is that the same sort of feeling that you got, Andrew?
Yeah, I have to say that you took the words out of my mouth in like a mixed bag of where, you know, I think the positive thing is I'm glad to see, you know, getting the publicity in the Gospel Coalition to reach a segment of readers who probably would typically say, "Wait, what's an Anglican?" So that's nice to get that exposure, along with really the opening paragraphs there, which we'll dive into in a moment. I think really hits very well that Anglicans, A, are not supposed to be wishy-washy, are not supposed to sit on the fence and say, "We have no boundaries." But at the same time, on the things, the items that he lays out as being our major problems, I feel like we may be looking at the problem from two different angles, or maybe even living in a little bit of a different place or a different time in terms of what the real enemy or enemies are when it comes to Anglicans being united on our doctrine. So, Archdeacon Isaac, what was kind of your takeaway when you first read this?
Yeah, I agree with both of y'all, and I saw that same exact response. Either people loved it or they thought it was the worst thing ever written in the Gospel Coalition. Our people either thought it was the best thing the Gospel Coalition has ever done or the worst thing it's ever done, which is pretty funny. I do agree. I think his general call for us to be rooted in the formularies, possibly in a confessional way, is a good one. Some of the specific things that he complained against, I'd like to push back a little bit. Not necessarily that he's wrong in what he says, but like you said, Andrew, it's probably the wrong target at this point. I didn't realize this until it had been being discussed for a few days, but he actually links to one of our articles on there from last year, which was an article by Jared Lovell. I hope I'm pronouncing Jared's last name right. Back in September of last year, calling for a move towards confessionalism, which I thought was a very good article as well. So it's nice to see us getting linked to in something as big as the Gospel Coalition.
Yep, absolutely. And we can include both the article that we are discussing here from Gillis Harp, as well as Jared's article at the North American Anglican in the show notes. And really, I think the comparison between the two gets at sort of the crux of maybe what was bothering some people or encouraging others about the Harp article, which is that, first of all, the idea that Anglicans would be confessional is either obviously true or obviously idiotic, depending on who you're talking to, right? And not only that, but if you agree that Anglicanism is confessional, has confessions, etc., there isn't really an agreement on what this should look like. And I think that maybe is sort of where the three of us are kind of approaching this article. There's clearly, we have authoritative documents. If you're a member of an Anglican church and your church belongs to a church body, your constitution and canons tell you what your authoritative documents are. And so, you know, people are a people under authority, whether you call that a confession or not. And we can sort of dig into what Gillis Harp means by confessional here in a minute. But, you know, the way that works out is not necessarily something everyone's going to be agreed on. Since we kind of decided we'd read through the first section and, just to make sure that we're all on the same page, that our audience, listeners at home, know what we're responding to, why don't I just start off with the first paragraph here? Since the latter part of the 20th century, Anglican churches in the West have experienced divisions over liberal theology and sexual ethics. In response, there's been a welcome reassertion of creedal orthodoxy in some quarters. My denomination, the Anglican Church in North America, is one expression of that response. Recently, several Anglican clergy have urged a return to a more self-conscious and consistent confessionalism. And that is where he links to the North American Anglican article by Jared Lovell. All sounds pretty above the board to me. Andrew, you want to take that next paragraph, or do you have any comments on what we've just heard?
Yeah, I'll take the next paragraph, but I'll add that his first sentence, I think, identifies exactly what the key divisions are. And so therefore, later on, we go into the, I think, 4 points that he makes on issues that he has with the Anglican Communion right now. I think it's interesting that it doesn't stick with that very first sentence over the divisions over liberal theology and sexual ethics. Let's kick it over to the next paragraph, and we'll get to that when it's time. Church of England clergy have long been required to subscribe to Anglicanism's 16th century confession, the 39 Articles. But the Protestant Episcopal Church unwisely chose not to require clerical subscription when it was formed in the 1780s. By the late 1970s, the Articles were relegated to a small print section at the back of the American Prayer Book, ominously titled Historical Documents of the Church. I'll kick it over to you, Isaac.
Yeah, there's a little bit I want to address in that paragraph, actually. Mm-hmm. In the 1780s, there was no subscription to the Articles. But by 1801, we had edited our own set of Articles in the American Church, a very light edit. Not uncontroversial at the time, but the best way that the American Church decided to be as uncontroversial as possible is just have very, very light editing for political situations, basically, of the articles. And then they were put into the constitution of the Episcopal Church. And the reason why subscription wasn't required is because they thought it was redundant. They're like, you're already vowing to uphold the doctrine and practice of the church. It's there in the constitution. Therefore, you're subscribing to it de facto. Granted, that might not have been the wisest thing, but you know, an article I pulled up by Bishop Peter Robinson on the anniversary of the articles, he notes that by 1844, it's now being kind of a sufficient testimony to the beliefs of the church. There was an attempt to remove them by 1925, and then as Dr. Harp said, by 79, they're just relegated to the historical documents. But that all of that to say is that, and that parallels the things going on in England at the time too, by the way. So we weren't less subscriptional than England. It's just it was approached in a different way. But yeah, let me pick up this next paragraph of the intro here. Yeah, I mean that's a bit of a quibble on my part, but I think it's important to note that we actually did consider it important in the American church for most of our history.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, next paragraph. In ensuring that clergy embrace and laity study the articles and our other often forgotten but official formularies, the 1662 Book of Common Prayer and the First and Second Book of Homilies could help fix the doctrinal incoherence Anglicans have grappled with for decades. I think all three of us would say amen. That's something that we've been advocating to one extent or another here at the North American Anglican for a while. Oh, Jesse.
Yeah, I think he's right on that we have historical standards that we, you know, are interested in refamiliarizing, you know, ourselves and North American Anglicans with. And it's not controversial to say that Anglicanism, doctrinally speaking, is a bit of an anomaly in the reformational world, right? That very often Calvinists and Lutherans look at us like it's impossible to know what you guys think about anything. And it's not, you know, I think Harp is right to say, look, it's not because we don't have standards. It's probably got more to do with the fact that historically we have not been quite as authoritative in applying those standards necessarily. But as you say, Father Isaac, clearly we don't want to overstate the case either. You know, the Episcopal Church did have that requirement. It just looked a little bit different. So yes, we're all in agreement. I'll read this next big block as quickly as I can. The articles will help reinvigorate Anglican theology because they reflect the core teaching of the Protestant Reformation, the supremacy and sufficiency of the scriptures, the justification of sinners by grace through faith, the spiritual meaning of the sacraments, and their intimate connection to the gospel. These are primary teachings Anglicans everywhere must never abandon, and many Orthodox Anglican congregations do a commendable job teaching these brilliant reformational truths. Amen. But that you can just tell, you can sense there's a but coming, can't you? All right, Father Andrew, that's the but is all yours.
The but is all mine, so I'll pick up on that. So, quote, but not all traditions and practices within Anglicanism today sit easily with our historic confessional standards. The following practices stray from biblical doctrine, and confessional Anglicans should reconsider them. And so he then leads us into several points of what are these practices that do not sit easily with our historic confessional standards. And before we jump into that, I know Archdeacon Isaac, you were mentioning something about confessions and confessionalism and formularies. I was curious if you had anything to add in terms of the differences between those and the similarities between those statements?
Yeah, I think if you're going to make a difference between the articles of religion and I will intentionally use this word, other confessions of the time. It's the scope's a little bit different. And so people make a lot out of that scope being different. You know, the idea being that the articles are a bit narrower in what they're looking at than, say, Westminster or Augsburg and things like that. And that really we when we think about them as formularies, it's more in the idea that along with the Book of Homilies, the Ordinal, and the Prayer Book, we kind of have a core group of documents. But I would dare say that any of our confessional Lutheran friends would say, yeah, we're kind of the same way. You know, it's not that much different. And so I think a lot of times there's some semantic hair splitting over this that is less, it's a kind of a distinction without a difference. So I'm going to read real quick the article on confessionalism from the Episcopal Dictionary of the Church. So this is the official TEC definition of confessionalism.
Let's have it.
Confessionalism. Adherence of a church or denomination to a particular standards, expressions, confessions, doctrines, or symbols of faith. Confessional statements focus and codify the beliefs of a church or denomination and distinguish the church's beliefs from the beliefs of others outside the church. So far, it all checks the boxes, right? And here's the real fun sentence. Many confessional statements were made during the era of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, including the Augsburg Confession, Lutheran, the Westminster Confession, Presbyterian, the 39 Articles, Anglican, and the Canons and Decrees of the Council of Trent, Roman Catholic. then they talk about how you use the confessional statements for your catechism, catechetical training, and then why, you know, some people see it as pejorative, meaning that it's too narrow in its view. And I think that's really where the people that detract from wanting to call the articles a confession in our own circles are. They're like, well, we don't want to say that we're any different from what the church has always done. But a mere Christianity approach to Anglicanism leads to not Anglicanism. Or, I mean, you can't have a tradition without some sort of boundaries. And just to say, oh, we do what the fathers and the creed say. Yeah, but the fathers don't agree with each other. And so you get to pick and choose. So anyway, that's a bit of a pet peeve of mine. So you might not want to call it confessional. That's fine. I don't really care. But I think we do fit the standards when we're actually going to define what a confession is, rather than just say we're not Presbyterians. Okay, we know that. You know,
like that. We're just not Presbyterians. Yeah. How do you define Anglicanism? We're not Presbyterians. That doesn't help.
Right. But we're not a lot of things, really.
Yeah, which is why we have a confession, because we're not a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is what's funny, because I think it's been like a year or longer when we talked about like the fundamental declarations at some point that are within ACNA, and then you have a fundamental declaration with GAFCON and something similar with the Global South Anglican Fellowship. And of course, all of them list the 39 articles, the 1662 Book of Common Prayer and Ordinal attached. And I think I made a joke ages ago of like, if you don't want to call it confessionalism, then what are we going to call it? You know, fundamentalism? Yeah. Because we're right. Fundamental declarationists, you know?
Yep. Yeah, there's no way around this idea that different communities have their own idea of or conception of what's true, and specificity does not make you less Catholic. Just ask all the people who consider themselves Catholic, right? So, I'll just introduce one distinction that might be useful, might not. In Lutheran circles, there's this idea of a distinction between a quia subscription to the confessions or a quantenus subscription, which is the difference between I confess this to be true because it is true or because it agrees with the scriptures, versus insofar as it agrees with the scriptures. And you can obviously see how insofar as leaves a lot of wiggle room, like who gets to say when it doesn't, right? But you can also see on the other side that because it agrees with the scriptures can easily elevate the confession to this almost infallible level, at which point,
divine. Yeah.
Right. So there's dangers on either side of that, and I don't think we need to really delve too far into that, but it is, you know, maybe something we can have rolling in the background. We'll leave that tab open, listener, in your browser as we cover these 4 points.
That's a good point, I just want to add real quick that not only the Lutherans but also the Presbyterians do the same thing. That's a very fair point to make there.
Yeah. So point number one from Gillis Harp at the Gospel Coalition, reserving and venerating the sacrament of communion.
I start to say those are not the same thing. Reserving and venerating is not the same thing.
Yeah, flesh that out for us.
So we see reservation as far back as Justin Martyr historically. But the way it was done more than anything else was reservation for a purpose. It was for the purpose of bringing the leftovers of our holy meal to those who could not be at the holy meal, the sick, the shut-ins, that sort of thing. And again, that goes all the way back. Justin Martyr talks about that. That's early second century stuff. And arguably, this is the main reason why reservation has happened historically. Veneration is a bit different, where you use that reserved sacrament for the purpose of as a devotional aid in some way. I mean, where there's a spectrum of how that works, but as a devotional aid in some way. And just because it's reserved does not mean it's necessarily venerated. And I think that does get to the problem that Article 28 has with reservation. It's the abuse of reservation that our reformers saw happening in the Middle Ages.
I think that's a great point. And Harp rightfully quotes from Article 28, but he does include like something that's not there. What it reads in Article 28 is the last sentence. The sacrament of the Lord's Supper was not established. Let me misquote it. The sacrament of the Lord's Supper was not by Christ's ordinance reserved, carry about, lifted up, or worship. He adds, was not by Christ's ordinance, you know, adds to be reserved, carried about, lifted up, or worshiped. And I think there's a distinction that needs to be made there, because Article 28 there talks about reserving it for it to be carried about, lifted up, and worshiped, that veneration you're talking about, Archdeacon Isaac. And I think that's important, because one could read it and interpret it as saying any reservation like is a problem, because it's going to be venerated. And the veneration is a huge problem and cannot be done under the articles. But then if you go to Article 25, I think you get more context of what is the main problem. Because in the first sentence of the last paragraph of Article 25, it says, the sacraments were not ordained of Christ to be gazed upon or to be carried about, but that we should duly use them. And so I would argue there that there's a distinction in terms of if you're reserving in order to give it to the sick, you're duly using them. That's different than reserving it so that you can venerate it, or as it says in the articles, to gaze upon it, to essentially engage in processionals. Along with, as you mentioned, Archdeacon Isaac, we have the early church going back to at least Justin Martyr, noting that it was not so much reserved to hold around and keep in the church, but was reserved to immediately take out to those sick parishioners so that they may duly receive that sacrament.
And we can acknowledge, you know, with intellectual honesty, that post-Reformation, the English Church was very against reserving for any purpose. I mean, so that's, he's right about that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't think this through theologically and come to a way to do, you know, if you're going to do it, there are some good biblical reasons to do it and some good historical reasons to do it without getting into the abuse. When he talks about stray from biblical doctrine, I think I want to push back a little bit on that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's an important sort of distinction that we can add to the Harp framework here, which is to say, these are confessions that we all agree we should be obedient and faithful to. We agree with Harp on that. But does obedience mean completely mimicking the practice of the people who wrote these confessions or the customs, etc. Or, and I think this is maybe a principle we'll end up applying through all these points, does this perhaps involve an ongoing reformation? I think, Andrew, you mentioned this earlier in our private chat, that, you know, we can revisit these issues. We can look at the spirit and the intent of the article. And without contradicting it, first of all, let me just say, I think that bracketing 2B was pretty sneaky and is not the most honest thing. It's one way you might read that article, but it's not necessarily the only way it can be read. And so that frames things in a way that makes an openness to any kind of reservation seem illicit, right? Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to jump and just say, yeah, it's ironic. He's like reforming the article while trying to argue from the article. And the point that I was making like earlier in our chat was that the church, you know, is always reforming and always in need of reform. And Harp is trying to do that, you know, to his credit. He's trying to point out some issues here. And he's absolutely right on the veneration. We see that in some Anglican churches, and that's a problem. But the reservation for the purpose of the sick, that kind of gets it to where I'm thinking that we're missing the point of our Anglican reformers, who bishops like Jewell, he even goes on to talk about how when it comes to confirmation and other things like laying on of hands, the problem is not confirmation. We retain that. The problem is not laying on of hands. The problem is upholding and requiring, unless you use oil, then it's invalid. And unless you use this prayer over the oil, then it has no effect. And that's where, even within our own practice, there is a reform of how we retain the confirmation and other aspects of the church. And so likewise, I think that we restrict ourselves from further reforming back to the ancient church in order to help the least of these, our sick members, and especially as we're approaching a time in the Western world where so many, that the baby boomer generation is only getting older, and so there'll be even more visitations, and especially after COVID died, in which so much of my personal ministry had to go to the flock in order to serve them.
And the service, the way that historically the prayer book handled this was having a particular form of consecration at the sick person's house or bed or whatever. I think things have changed culturally in a way that makes that a lot harder. Taking communion to a sick person in the hospital, you do not have the time to do a consecration with any sense of solemnity, because you're getting interrupted every 5 minutes by nurses and doctors and beeps and things like that. And it's, you know, it's having something a bit quicker and a bit more practical is very helpful in that situation.
I'll add this too, because the context of like communion to the sick, it has in the rubric that the person who is receiving, that family, that household, needs to notify the minister how many will be there so that he can bring appropriately, you know, how much wine and how much of the bread. You're doing a full service. And so, and you also have the rubric in the traditional Holy Communion of like, you have to have at least, correct me if I'm wrong, but at least three, as I recall, to even have Holy Communion. So the presumption of communion to the sick is we are bringing the service to the local church, the local family that's there. And when it was made, it was typically thinking of you're sick in your household, not off in a hospital. And it's just you, because, you know, family come and go, people try to stay with you. So you show up and it's just you and many times the person who is sick. And so you got two people, you know. So, I mean, which rubric are we going to violate here? It's not going to be perfect.
Yeah. And speaking of Jewell, you mentioned number of the sacraments. You did some work on Jewell, Andrew, that addresses this. So that's the next point.
Indeed. Yeah, we should move along, because there's more points and we could probably break each one of these up into its own episode, and maybe we should. Expanding the number of sacraments. Harp here says, yet Article 25 is clear. There are two sacraments ordained of Christ our Lord in the gospel. That is to say, baptism and the Supper of the Lord. The article goes on to explain carefully Those five commonly called sacraments have not like the nature of sacraments with baptism and the Lord's Supper, for they have not any visible sign or ceremony ordained of God. Well, does that mean that they're not like the other sacraments at all? Is my first question. Or does that mean that they're just not the same? And when we say commonly called sacraments, including in the article that Harp quotes, does that mean that calling these things sacraments or sacramental in some sense is illicit? Or what do you guys think?
Yeah, so he goes on then to contrast that with the ACNA's catechism. He doesn't explicitly call it out as being the ACNA's, but it is the ACNA's catechism that speaks of the other five as sometimes called sacraments of the church. And again, I mean, the catechism, I recently taught through this section on another podcast. And the catechism actually is making the same distinction as the article. It's just using it does acknowledge that these days some people do call them sacraments of the church instead. But I think it's important to realize that the term sacrament is a church word anyway. The issue is, how are we defining that? And so keep our definitions precise, like the ACNA catechism does, and you have no problem with what's being said in the article. And then, as I mentioned, Jewel says something about this that I'm going to kick that to Andrew, our yeah. Jewel expert.
Yeah, I do not hold myself out to be an expert, but I've just read more Jewel probably than average Joe these days. But Jewel, you know, when he attacks this in his two treatises, not his apology, which almost has semi-authoritative status, the Apology of the Church of England, but in the two treatises, what he knocks is, look, we uphold there's two sacraments of the gospel, basically quoting what the article is. And then he goes on to make a point that a lot of Eastern Orthodox will make, that so many things could be considered sacraments of the church. Why are we stopping at seven? He goes on to like foot washing, you know, and just continues on and on through a litany. And he makes the point of, we're upholding there are two sacraments of the gospel. Later on, after he makes the statement, a few paragraphs, he doesn't really have chapters, but approximately a few chapters later in the work, he then talks about, we have confirmation, we retained it, we reformed it. We have, you know, ordination of ministers. It's a holy calling and a holy vocation. But he is basically dismantling the Roman Catholic theology of that time of, well, you're getting an extra dose of grace. You're getting an extra dose of this substance. And therefore, you're being made more holy, more set apart. It's far more noble to have any of one of these other sacraments, which we now refer to as either sacraments of the church, sacramentals, but certainly not sacraments of the gospel. So while I agree that we need to uphold that the sacraments of the gospel, you know, is what brings you into the covenant and nourishes you into the covenant of our Lord, the new covenant, I personally and anecdotally don't see that this is the biggest problem that we're facing within the Anglican communion these days. I think the very first sentence that Harp started off with of liberal theology and a denial of the power and the authority of the scriptures, that's really what we're facing in terms of having problems throughout the communion. And another thing that I'll note is that in the two books of homilies, I believe, I looked it up and have forgotten already, I think it's in the second book of homilies that Jewel helped edit and even author several of them, even calls marriage a sacrament, you know, so loosely uses that language just to note that that's an elevated, you know, like calling, a holy calling. You don't get extra grace under, you know, medieval theology, but it's a holy calling and a sacrament nonetheless. So one of the, of course, authorities that Harp is calling us to remember is the homilies. And so just something to note.
Yeah, the very, two verses seven argument. Yeah, exactly. the two verses seven argument just isn't something we should be going to the mat over in 21st century Anglicanism. You know, the old catechism has a very precise definition. So does the new catechism. And by both of those, it clearly makes baptism and the Lord's Supper what our articles want them to be. So, I mean, yeah, this is not something I'd go to the mat over.
Yeah, unless you want to take the five and either excise them altogether, which would be doing violence to our confessions as well, or attempt to renounced this role of the Holy Spirit in those sacraments, which also does violence to the Book of Common Prayer and the plain meaning of those confessions. It seems a bit pedantic. As long as we're willing to make that distinction, then, yeah, we've got bigger fish to fry, including, well, maybe not, but this, I think this will be one of the more controversial parts. Praying for the dead. Do the dead need our prayers, gentlemen? What do you think?
So Augustine, in his I can't pronounce this very well, Irenicum, he says so. I don't know that I agree with his reasoning. He doesn't really give reasoning. He just kind of makes some guesses. But I think more importantly is, you know, Dr. Harp references a change in the 1928 Book of Common Prayer that I think spilled over, at least in some way, into the ACNA's 2019, where there is a petition for continued growth of the deceased believers. When the revisers in the American 1928 were, A, this was not an uncontroversial thing for the same reasons, but in their mind, they were returning to a patristic model once again. This idea that there is some sort of natural offering up prayers for, not just Thanksgiving, but also prayers for those who've gone before us. And I'll admit, I'm a lot less comfortable with this than some of these other things. But again, I'm gonna talk, you know, quote Bishop Robinson when he talked in a recent article he did about the 1928. He says that he basically points out that if you take this as imprecise and unfortunate of a clause as this is, with the other formularies in hand, you're never going to get to purgatory over it. And which is not the point, you know, reintroducing purgatory was never the point of that prayer. You know, it's similar to reservation and adoration. Can this lead to purgatory? Yes. Must it lead to purgatory? Not necessarily.
Andrew, yeah, what do you think?
I think that's well said, Archdeacon. I'm kind of the same opinion of, you know, like, this is something that I can live with or without in terms of the 1928s. It is an innovation that they added there, but I like how you word it. It was looking towards the early patristics in terms of the prayer and what it really is aiming at. And from reading that prayer, which I've not had any need to utilize in public worship because it's confined to the burial office and it's an optional prayer in the 28 as memory serves, is that it really is looking more towards continued sanctification with Christ. Is that something is that a hill I want to die on? No, I could live with or without it. But I think the greater point that you just made is, does this mean that we believe in purgatory? No, absolutely not. I mean, especially, and I'm not even talking about the reformulated purgatory that you see recently in Roman Catholic circles, but that medieval doctrine of purgatory of, well, you've got to go pay off your sins. You're not quite there yet. You know, kind of the classic thing my kids say in the car, you know, are we there yet? Nope, we've still got a few more 100 years until we get there. Hopefully someone on the other side still living is praying us out. That's not the theology is being taught there. And especially since this is just one prayer that's in the 28 book, and I think you're correct that a form of it is retained in the 2019 prayer book, my bigger concerns is really departing wholesale from the classic prayer book tradition is what's happening all throughout Western churches, including the Church of England, of creating these new liturgies, blessing what God has not blessed. I think that's the bigger concern and the bigger problem that we have.
Yeah, I think Father Rayburg, can you confirm? I could have sworn there was a line in the Holy Communion service that had something to do with their continued grace or something.
It's in the prayer for the whole state of Christ Church. There is a kind of one line hint at that. I mean,
okay, real quick. Well, while you're looking that up, I'll just give my two cents on this whole issue. I think, first of all, let me just say I know friends who have departed loved ones who absolutely cherish that part of the 28 prayer book. And that's not a reason to change your confessions or your theology necessarily, but they are not people who believe in purgatory per se either. So I think that, first of all, I'll just echo this. Harp seems worried that certain practices, if misunderstood, could lead us to a belief in purgatory. And I just think, well, okay, let's just not misunderstand them.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like the most obvious answer. And so this whole anxiety of like, oh no, if there's an image in some stained glass, I might be tempted to worship it. You know, like it's a similar sort of anxiety over images, is like, this thing might be abused in this particular way that we know the church rejects. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean that that's what's happening here, right? So that's a sort of hermeneutic of suspicion, right, that we're applying to the 28, which is hard to be an American Anglican and not see the 28 as having had a sort of legitimate position to be semper reformanda, right, and to adjust its own tradition, granting that we all agree that these adjusting or readdressing of the tradition are not always faithful to the confessions. But
yeah,
Father.
Yeah, so at the end of the prayer for the whole state of Christ Church, it says, "And we also bless thy holy name for all thy servants departed this life in thy faith and fear," which was in the older ones too, "beseeching thee to grant them continual growth in thy love and service, and to give us grace so to follow their good examples." You can't get further away from purgatory than that. Right. I mean, we're not following somebody's good example into purgatory. You know, someone in purgatory is not in God's service, you know, that's not the way that works. So, and what comes to mind is the Latin legal expression. I'm going to be speaking Venerable Andrew's language here, maybe, abusus non tollit usum, you know, the misuse does not remove the use. And I think that even though our reformers in their context would have seen some of these things as there is no way to properly use them, that's because they were in the middle of the abuse. And, yep, you know, and so that's I think that's something that we ought to think about as we look at some of these controversies.
Well said. Speaking of controversies, let's talk about affirming apostolic succession. Dun, dun, dun. First of all, let me just say that I'm pretty sure that Gillis Harp thinks we should all read Philip Edgecombe Hughes' book on the Reformers, and it's a good book. You should read it, for sure. But he kind of just, articulates a view here that posits two realities as opposed to one another. Those realities being a faithful passing on of the biblical doctrines and a tactile succession of blessing bishops from the apostles. Andrew, what's going on here?
Yeah, and I think he makes a good point in terms of there is a stress in these modern times on apostolic succession as the end-all be-all. But I also think that he's overstating his case on the fact that the apostolic succession for the English reformers was the fact that we still have a line of ministers having the lay on of hands dating back to the earliest centuries. And more importantly, we also have the doctrine going back to the earliest centuries. So Jewell, who he quotes, along with so many of the other Anglican reformers, constantly fought this battle against the Roman Catholic Church, saying we're Catholic because we have retained that which was, you know, distorted, marred, and was really put into, through a mirror darkly for so many centuries. And so one of the beauties of the Anglican Reformation is they retained the laying on of hands in terms of the ministry, but also had the doctrine that goes back to the earliest centuries, which is something that the Eastern Orthodox Church will also stress in terms of how they view ministry. And they don't quite have the same theology as Rome of valid or invalid or illicit, you know, sacraments and ordinations, etc. They also are looking at what is the doctrine that is being taught. And so I don't think you can simply just kick out the fact that we do have a succession and its importance, especially as the English Reformation continues. You do have in the early Reformation some ministers who are not reordained, who are coming from the continent and minister in the Church of England. But then by the time you get to the 1662, which, as he noted, is our formulary, it's a requirement that in order to be one of those rightly ordained ministers, as the article upholds, you need to go through the service of the ordinal, which involves the laying on of hands dating back to earliest centuries. Isaac, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's all of those are exactly right. You know, and a good question is why by the time we get to the late 17th century and the Restoration is that stress on episcopal ordination so much there. And I think it's because the English church saw what happens when things go off the rails, when the nonconformists are running the show. We get regicide and, you know, and executing of bishops. And that doesn't mean that, you know, this is not saying, oh, you know, this is not talking about Presbyterianism or Congregationalism in of itself, but good order is important, I think, is the thing. I mean, that's really the issue, is that what the English Civil War saw was a breakdown of good order, a breakdown of God-ordained order. And the other thing is, unless we're looking at some of the weird Anabaptists or the Puritans who were rebelling against the English church in many ways, all of the continental reformers wanted episcopacy. They just couldn't get it.
Calvin and so, request.
Yeah. And so, I mean, by the time we get to the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral in the 19th century, basically we're saying, yeah, this original intention of everybody having the historic episcopacy, let's actually do that. Now, granted, by then you've got 300 years of people going in different directions, but literally nobody except for some of the Puritans were arguing that we ought to get rid of bishops.
Yeah, and I'll add this, that to read Harp charitably, I think that he would be correct. He doesn't word it exactly this way, but I think he's trying to get at those Anglicans who say that, well, if you just don't have apostolic succession, then you just lack grace in your church. Now, that's definitely an overstatement, not an official position of the Anglican Church, very much is rewriting history, which is a concern that he has, in which he's pointing to the 19th century when it comes to the Oxford movement. So I don't want to completely throw out what he's trying to say, but I'm having to kind of read it more in that direction. But it's a point worth noting.
And that is a danger, is that I know a lot of Anglicans who basically say, I can't go to a church if it doesn't have bishops. I'd rather go to Rome than go to the Presbys or the Lutherans if I'm in a place that doesn't have an Anglican church. Yep. And I do think that's a bit of a problem, because theologically we ought to be a lot closer to our other magisterial reformer folks, like the Gospel Coalition is set up to do, right? I mean, that this is a good venue for his article. I feel like there's more commonality with the Lutherans and the Presbyterians than there is with the Roman Catholics doctrinally.
Yeah, I agree. I think that when you think of the conservative Reformation or the high magisterial Reformation, Anglicanism certainly belongs to that family, although each sort of body of divinity and practice is distinct. And obviously the episcopacy and retaining that tactile succession was a distinctive of the Anglican branch. So to me, it kind of boils down to a both and versus either or. Approach, which has clearly been the historic practice. So Yeah, I think Andrew's right to say we don't want to side with the sort of, you know, Anglicans who are basically theologically old Catholics or some kind of Western Rite Orthodox who are trying to renounce the Reformation altogether as though it were un-Catholic in its essence and, you know, are clinging to some sort of magical Episcopal connection that can somehow be upheld as against or above the truths of the Catholic truths of the Reformation, you know. So that's clearly an error, but it's also an error to say that it's not important at all. And as you know, both of you have mentioned, Calvin wrote to the Archbishop of Canterbury requesting episcopacy. Didn't work out so well, but he also wrote and I recall distinctly him saying, but hey, look, what we have done is we've continued the ancient practice of laying on of hands in a presbyteral way, right? So clearly, even from a continental reformational perspective, there's actually a sense that even if bishops is your problem, they do kind of in practice and perhaps even in intent uphold an apostolic presbyteral succession, you know. And I recall you mentioned the Lambeth Quadrilateral or the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral, and I think Presbyterian or Reformed thinker Philip Schaff was all in a huff about the historic episcopacy, preferring rather the historic presbytery. But even that is still a nod towards some sense that, hey, guess what? An apostolic continuation that's not just doctrinal, but also tactile and ministerial was a value, right? Even from a Presbyterian perspective. So I think the idea that this can be thrown away altogether is just a different kind of error than maybe the hardline Anglo-Papalist type error.
Yeah, I'd agree. I the only thing I'd add to that is I even know most of the Baptist pastors I know insist on some form of laying on of hands because, you know, they would probably see the episcopacy as a bad thing. A lot of those guys, but they still recognize that is the biblical model. And so, yeah, that tactile and nobody that's worth listening to, let's put it that way, thinks you can just hang out a shingle and call yourself a pastor.
I think that's the crazy Anabaptist you mentioned earlier, Father. well, with that, I think we've reached the end of Harp's article, and we can probably wrap it up for today. But it was a good chat, and I think we covered a lot of ground. And I almost want to just go back and do an episode per point there, because I do think we had so much more to unpack. But for now, I will bid our audience and my co-hosts adieu.
It was the spirit of our forefathers that built that grand building. I believe that spirit is with us still and will help us to rebuild it one day when we've served and suffered a while, a little longer. Build it again to the glory of Jesus Christ.
Miserable Offenders is a production of the North American Anglican. Learn more at NORTHAM Anglican.com.